Dane Allred's Rules of Engagement, Sheepherder Translation. As per usual, I got stuck on the side of the road in the middle of nowhere. I'm trying to get to a stand of pine trees to cut into pine poles and posts. I head back down the road in the beautiful mountains of Utah at the ripe age of 17 and put my left rear tire into midair on the dirt road. My truck was belching blue smoke, and the sheep herder nearby thought there might be a fire. As he rode up on his horse, I've never been so glad to see another human being. There really is no desperation quite like being stuck in the top of the mountains, especially when you think no one else who can help you is closer than 50 miles away. The old man listened patiently to my stupidity, and then he said he thought if he tied his rope to the back of the truck, his horse could pull the rear end of my truck back onto the road. I was out of ideas and welcomed the help. He was right. As he pulled the rope backwards with his horse, I put the truck in reverse, and one cloud of blue smoke later, I was back on the road. I jumped out to thank him, and he invited me to come to his trailer for coffee. This man had just saved my life, and I was obligated to at least spend a little time with him as payment. A sheepherder goes up the mountain in the spring and has little human contact the entire summer, mostly just getting supplies from his employer and going to town once in a while. It would have been the height of rudeness to refuse his hospitality, especially after his rescue of me and my truck. I decided to play it by ear and at least show the respect of spending some time with him. The very first thing he did was pour the coffee and hand it to me with a smile. I found out that this man was from Colorado and that he had two sons who drove trucks for some company up there. After we talked for a few more minutes, he confessed to me that he didn't read English all that well. Spanish was his native language. He pulled out a letter and asked me if I would read it to him. He indicated that a girl he had met at a dance in town a couple of weeks ago had sent it to him. What would the address be? And he couldn't read it. He asked if I would read it for him. He had rescued me from the mountain. He had offered me the hospitality of coffee in his trailer. It didn't seem like an outlandish request, but remember, this is a personal letter from a woman to a man. I had no idea if there would be suggestive or other language in the letter, but I decided I'd better read it to him and then excuse myself before he had me write a reply. It was actually a sweet moment after all. The woman wrote to him about how she had enjoyed his company and hoped she would see him again. The awkwardness of the situation seemed to fade, but for anyone else who may have happened by, they would have seen a young man reading a love letter to an old man while they sat having coffee in a sheepherder's trailer. I can still see it in my mind. The old man sat there patiently listening while I read the words of a woman that he couldn't read himself. It was so personal and so involved that I found myself detaching from the situation and ignoring the words. I vanished from the scene, and it was just this old man and a woman who cared for each other communicating in the only way they could. I finished the letter and stood abruptly. I was uncomfortable, but the old man was only grateful. We had helped each other out, and the debt was paid. I excused myself and thanked him for the help and the hospitality, and I never saw him again. We spent perhaps 30 or 40 minutes together, but this memory is one that will always warm my heart. I think it is only when we are reaching out to one another to help in any way we can that we fully live. Even if it is just reading a love note to someone who can't read it, or just pulling some dumb kid's truck back onto the road with your horse. I wonder why it's the little things like this that make us feel truly a part of humanity. Good luck on your next dirt road. Whistling means that melodic tune must mean it's time for another episode of Philosophy by Marcus Tenacious Noggin. I'm like a bulldog, I won't let go. That might be why my mama named me Marcus Tenacious Noggin. Empty Noggin. At your service. Road rage and restaurant rage. I appreciate the road workers keeping me up to date. There's always a sign here and there that says road work ahead. I like to know that the road works, but I don't know if I need so many signs telling me. It seems like a waste of taxpayer money, usually. The roads don't work so well every time I see one of those road work ahead signs. I do have a bit of the arthritis, and it seems like these same shovel crews are worried about me checking that my shoulder works. I don't know if I need a sign telling me to check my shoulder. Shoulder work ahead? Whose business is that? And even though I am a good God-fearing Christian man, I think there is a line that needs to be drawn between church and state. I have recently become aware of the road crews promoting Christianity, and, you know, it's only a matter of time before one of these other religions complains, and then those signs are going to have to come down. You've seen those signs I'm talking about. Look up and live. It's just another promotion of religion, and like I said, I am a Sunday go-to-meeting kind of guy, but look up and live, it's just going to cause problems. Or you can't call me Empty Noggin. Those asphalt jockeys are getting pretty smart about it, too, putting those look up and live signs right under those high-power electrical wires. Very, very subtle. And those deer crossing signs. At least nowadays, the deer on the signs look like deer. Back in the good old days, I remember looking at those deer signs and wondering who drew it. Because it looked like a dog with horns, not a deer. I just hope these new signs work better than the old ones, because if the deer on the sign don't look like a deer, how are those deer going to know where to cross? We may have just caused more senseless deer casualties because they were looking at a sign wondering if this is the right place for deer to cross or is it a place for dogs with horns. I just think it is a humanitarian thing to do, you know, putting those signs up so the deer know where to cross. It just shows what kind of caring people live here in the U.S. of A. But don't get me started about those fallen rock signs. Why would you put those near roads? Oh, also, I just want to take this opportunity to apologize to the waiter I was rude to yesterday. I'm usually a pleasant kind of person, but when my back gets up, watch out. I don't know what was in my craw that made me complain in no uncertain terms that I was not pleased by being made to wait for a seat at that fancy restaurant yesterday. It may have been the fact that I'm a pretty ornery looking fellow with my wild whiskers and crazy hair. I do look a sight, and I'm not the kind of person most people want to see at an upscale feed bag place. I'm kind of surprised they didn't stick me in the back corner, which has been done to me before. After I calmed down, I felt bad, so I wound up leaving a really good tip. But that still don't mean I should have been rude. Sorry, Mr. Maitre D', sometimes even Empty Noggin puts on airs. But the real message here is you can't judge a book by its cover. I may look like a crusty old coot, and sometimes my manners ain't the best, but I gave that waiter the best bump he had all day, probably a 30% tip. Those table-waiting people deserve it, putting up with all the nonsense us uppity people dish out. But don't be judging us scroungy-looking sorts. All one summer, when I was especially hairy-faced and wild-looking, I couldn't get no good service nowhere. People would just ignore me, hoping I was going away, but I just stood my ground waiting for them to do their job, which was to serve me. The worst place was those convenience stores. I couldn't walk up and down an aisle without having someone in my tail wondering what I was getting ready to steal. The sad part about this whole tale is that the community as a whole is a God-fearing, Jesus-loving people. They want everybody to know that Jesus loves them, but he might not love you if you have a scroungy beard or uncombed hair. Makes you wonder what kind of service Jesus would get around here if he came back and wanted a seat in an upscale place. He'd probably make him wear shoes and a tie. Come to think of it, if he went to church, he probably wouldn't get in the door, especially if he's wearing sandals. That's right. Mersey dotes and dozy dotes and little lambsy divey, a kid'll eat ivy too, wouldn't you? Just remember, you heard it first. Here from Empty Noggin. Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 28 by William Shakespeare. How can I then return in happy plight, that am debarred the benefit of rest, when day's oppression is not eased by night, but day by night and night by day oppressed? And each, though enemies to either's reign, do in consent shake hands to torture me, the one by toil, the other to complain how far I toil, still farther off from thee. I tell the day, to please them thou art bright, and dost him grace when clouds do blot the heaven. So flatter I the swart complexioned night, when sparkling stars twire not, thou gildest the even. But day doth daily draw my sorrows longer, and night doth nightly make grief's strength seem stronger. Are listening to Abundance, a selection from Dane Allred's Rules of Engagement, Sheepherder Translation, a selection from Empty Noggin, and Literature Out Loud, Sonnet 28 by William Shakespeare. Coming up, A Grimm's Fairy Tale, and the continuation of A Scandal in Bohemia from The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. Literature Out Loud, The Wolf and the Seven Little Kids by the Brothers Grimm. Once upon a time, an old goat who had seven little kids and loved them with all the love of a mother for her children. One day she wanted to go into the forest and fetch some food, so she called all seven to her and said, "Dear children, I have to go into the forest. Be on your guard against the wolf. If he comes in, he will devour you all, skin, hair, and all. The wretch often disguises himself, but you will know him at once by his rough voice and his black feet." The kids said, "Dear mother, we will take good care of ourselves. You may go away without any anxiety." Then the old one bleated and went on her way with an easy mind. It was not long before someone knocked at the house door and cried, "Open the door, dear children. Your mother is here and has brought back something with her for each of you." But the little kids knew that it was the wolf by the rough voice. "We will not open the door," cried they. "Thou art not our mother. She has a soft, pleasant voice, but thy voice is rough. Thou art the wolf." Then the wolf went away to a shopkeeper and bought himself a great lump of chalk, ate this, and made his voice soft with it. Then he came back, knocked at the door of the house, and cried, "Open the door, dear children. Your mother is here and has brought something back with her for each of you." But the wolf had laid his black paws against the window, and the children saw them and cried, "We will not open the door. Our mother has not black feet like thee. Thou art the wolf." Then the wolf ran to a baker and said, "I have hurt my feet. Rub some dough over them for me." And when the baker had rubbed his feet over, he ran to the miller and said, "Strew some white meal over my feet for me." The miller thought to himself, "The wolf wants to deceive someone," and refused. But the wolf said, "If thou wilt not do it, I will devour thee." Then the miller was afraid and made his paws white for him. Truly, men are like that. So now the wretch went for the third time to the house door, knocked at it, and said, "Open the door for me, children. Your dear little mother has come home and has brought every one of you something back from the forest with her." The little kids cried, "First, show us thy paws that we may know if thou art our dear little mother." Then he put his paws in through the window, and when the kids saw that they were white, they believed all that he said was true and opened the door. But who should come in but the wolf? They were terrified and wanted to hide themselves. One sprang under the table, the second into the bed, the third into the stove, the fourth into the kitchen, the fifth into the cupboard, the sixth under the washing bowl, and the seventh into the clock case. But the wolf found them all and used no great ceremony. One after the other, he swallowed them down his throat. The youngest in the clock case was the only one he did not find. When the wolf had satisfied his appetite, he took himself off, laid himself down under a tree in the green meadow outside, and began to sleep. Soon afterwards, the old goat came home again from the forest. Ah, what a sight she saw there! The house door stood wide open. The tables, chairs, and benches were thrown down. The washing bowl lay broken to pieces, and the quilts and pillows were pulled off the bed. She sought her children, but they were nowhere to be found. She called them, one after another, by name, but no one answered. At last, when she came to the youngest, a soft voice cried, "Dear mother, I am in the clock case." She took the kid out, and it told her that the wolf had come and had eaten all the others. Then you may imagine how she wept over her poor children. At length, in her grief, she went out, and the youngest kid ran with her. When they came to the meadow, there lay the wolf by the tree and snored so loud that the branches shook. She looked at him on every side and saw that something was moving and struggling in his gorged body. "Ah, heavens," said she, "is it possible that my poor children, whom he has swallowed down for his supper, can be still alive?" Then the kid had to run home and fetch scissors and a needle and thread, and the goat cut open the monster's stomach. And hardly had she made one cut than one little kid thrust its head out, and when she had cut farther, all six sprang out one after another, and were all still alive, and had suffered no injury whatever, for in his greediness the monster had swallowed them down whole. What rejoicing there was! Then they embraced their dear mother and jumped like a tailor at his wedding. The mother, however, said, "Now go and look for some big stones, and we will fill the wicked beast's stomach with them while he is still asleep." Then the seven kids dragged the stones thither with all speed and put as many of them into his stomach as they could get in. And the mother sewed him up again in the greatest haste so that he was not aware of anything and never once stirred. When the wolf at length had had his sleep out, he got on his legs, and as the stones in his stomach made him very thirsty, he wanted to go to a well to drink. But when he began to walk and to move about, the stones in his stomach knocked against each other and rattled. Then cried he, "What rumbles and tumbles against my poor bones? I thought 'twas six kids, but it's not but big stones." And when he got to the well and stooped over the water and was just about to drink, the heavy stones made him fall in, and there was no help, but he had to drown miserably. When the seven kids saw that, they came running to the spot and cried aloud, "The wolf is dead! The wolf is dead!" and danced for joy round about the well with their mother.
Thank you.
Bright Space by Dane Allred. Together again. I'm a stranger here. Here to observe, to learn, to live. You may feel like a stranger here too. We are the outsiders here from another place. We were together before this time in the bright space. We travel in this new place unknown to each other, struggling in a strange new place, waiting to make that connection with someone we knew before. But the best news is, we knew everyone before. Everyone who has ever lived, everyone who lives now, and everyone who will ever live. In the bright space, we waited for the opportunity to be more, to do more, to find out all there is to know, as this universe experiences itself through you and through me. When we are done with what we can learn here, we will be together again and share all that we have learned. There is such diversity in our world, an incredible variety of things, places, people, and other creatures to be experienced. One of us could not do a part of it in our lifetime. In such a world of abundance and wonder, there are so many things to do and find, but in the rush to do, we must also be. We must be there for others who are waiting for that helping hand from us, who are waiting for that spark from us that completes the circle from when we first met to today, when we meet again. Be the bright space, be present for that next time our paths cross, not for the first time, and certainly not for the last time. Be conscious of those around us, not walking with our eyes closed, unconscious of others moving through the same space as you and I. We knew each other before. We know each other still. We only need to reach out and make that reconnection. You know that feeling. You've met before. You are only meeting again. Now, there are no strangers here. We are together once again. Upside of the Head by Dane Allred. What's making you so sad? That feeling something bad is creeping around the bend, about to make an end of all those happy times? Time to get ready for that slap upside your head, that wake-up call that wakes you up and reminds you you're not dead. That gentle slap, that cursed snap that makes you real and makes you feel it's time to get to work. That slap can snap you back in shape. A slap upside the head can wake you up to what you have to do. So take that slap and grab your cape. This day is yours to make or break. Don't let it get the best of you. Thank you. Adventure Out Loud, The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Arthur Conan Doyle. Adventure 1, A Scandal in Bohemia, Part 2. At 3 o'clock, precisely, I was at Baker Street, but Holmes had not yet returned. The landlady informed me that he had left the house shortly after 8 o'clock in the morning. I sat down beside the fire, however, with the intention of awaiting him, however long he might be. I was already deeply interested in his inquiry, for though it was surrounded by none of the grim and strange features which were associated with the two crimes which I have already recorded, still, the nature of the case and the exalted station of his client gave it a character of its own. Indeed, apart from the nature of the investigation which my friend had on hand, there was something in his masterly grasp of a situation and his keen, incisive reasoning which made it a pleasure to me to study his system of work and follow the quick, subtle methods by which he disentangled the most inextricable mysteries. So accustomed was I to his invariable success that the very possibility of his failing had ceased to enter into my head. It was close upon 4 before the door opened, and a drunken-looking groom, ill-kempt and side-whiskered, with an inflamed face and disreputable clothes, walked into the room. Accustomed as I was to my friend's amazing powers in the use of disguises, I had to look 3 times before I was certain that it was indeed he. With a nod, he vanished into the bedroom, whence he emerged in 5 minutes, tweed-suited and respectable as of old. Putting his hands into his pockets, he stretched out his legs in front of the fire and laughed heartily for some minutes. "Well, really," he cried, and then he choked and laughed again until he was obliged to lie back, limp and helpless, in the chair. "What is it?" "It's quite too funny. I am sure you could never guess how I employed my morning or what I ended by doing." "I can't imagine. I suppose that you have been watching the habits, and perhaps the house, of Miss Irene Adler." "Oh, quite so. But the sequel was rather unusual, I will tell you, however. I left the house a little after 8 o'clock this morning in the character of a groom out of work. There is a wonderful sympathy in Freemasonry among horsey men. Be one of them, and you will know all that there is to know. I soon found Briony Lodge. It is a bijou villa with a garden at the back, but built out in front right up to the road, 2 stories. Chubb lock to the door, large sitting room on the right side, well furnished, with long windows almost to the floor, and those preposterous English window fasteners which a child could open. Behind there was nothing remarkable, save that the passage window could be reached from the top of the coach house. I walked round it and examined it closely from every point of view, but without noting anything else of interest. I then lounged down the street and found, as I expected, that there was a mews in a lane which runs down by one wall of the garden. I lent the ostlers a hand in rubbing down their horses, and received in exchange 2d, a glass of half and half, 2 fills of shag tobacco, and as much information as I could desire about Miss Adler, to say nothing of 6 other people in the neighborhood in whom I was not in the least interested, but whose biographies I was compelled to listen to. "And what of Irene Adler?" I asked. "Oh, she has turned all the men's heads down in that part. She is the daintiest thing under a bonnet on this planet. So say the Serpentine Muse to a man. She lives quietly, sings at concerts, drives out at 5 every day, and returns at 7 sharp for dinner. Seldom goes out at other times, except when she sings. Has only 1 male visitor, but a good deal of him. He is dark, handsome, and dashing, never calls less than 1 a day, and often 2. He is like Mr. Godfrey Norton of the Inner Temple. See the advantages of a cabman as a confidant. They had driven him home 12 times from Serpentine Mews and knew all about him. When I had listened to all they had to tell, I began to walk up and down near Briony Lodge once more and to think over my plan of campaign. This Godfrey Norton was evidently an important factor in the matter. He was a lawyer. That sounded ominous. What was the relation between them, and what was the object of his repeated visits? Was she his client, his friend, or his mistress? If the former, she had probably transferred the photograph to his keeping. If the latter, it was less likely. On the issue of this question depended whether I should continue my work at Briony Lodge or turn my attention to the gentleman's chambers in the temple. It was a delicate point, and it widened the field of my inquiry. I fear that I bore you with these details, but I have to let you see my little difficulties if you are to understand the situation.
Well, I am following you closely, I answered.
I was still balancing the matter in my mind when a hansom cab drove up to Briony Lodge and a gentleman sprang out. He was a remarkably handsome man, dark, aquiline, and mustached, evidently the man of whom I had heard. He appeared to be in a great hurry, shouted to the cabman to wait, and brushed past the maid who opened the door with the air of a man who was thoroughly at home. He was in the house about half an hour, and I could catch glimpses of him in the windows of the sitting room, pacing up and down, talking excitedly and waving his arms. Of her I could see nothing. Presently he emerged, looking even more flurried than before. As he stepped up to the cab, he pulled a gold watch from his pocket and looked at it earnestly.
"Drive like the devil!" he shouted. "First to Gross and Hankey's in Regent Street, and then to the Church of St. Monica in the Edgware Road. Half a guinea if you do it in 20 minutes!"
Away they went, and I was just wondering whether I should not do well to follow them when up the lane came a neat little landau, the coachman with his coat only half-buttoned, and his tie under his ear, while all the tags of his harness were sticking out of the buckles. It hadn't pulled up before she shot out of the hall and into it. I only caught a glimpse of her at the moment, but she was a lovely woman, with a face that a man might die for. "The Church of St. Monica, John," she cried, "and half a sovereign if you reach it in 20 minutes." This was quite too good to lose, Watson. I was just balancing whether I should run for it or whether I should perch behind her landau when a cab came through the street. The driver looked twice at such a shabby fare, but I jumped in before he could object. "The Church of St. Monica," said I, "and half a sovereign if you reach it in 20 minutes. It was 12:25, and of course it was clear enough what was in the wind. My cabby drove fast. I don't think I ever drove faster, but the others were there before us. The cab and the landau with their steaming horses were in front of the door when I arrived. I paid the man and hurried into the church. There was not a soul there save the two whom I had followed, and a surpliced clergyman who seemed to be expostulating with them. They were all three standing in a knot at the front of the altar. I lounged up the side aisle like any other idler who has dropped into a church. Suddenly, to my surprise, the three at the altar faced round me, and Godfrey Norton came running as hard as he could towards me. "Thank God!" he cried. "You'll do! Come, come!" "What then?" I asked. "Come, man, come! Only 3 minutes, or it won't be legal." I was half dragged up to the altar, and before I knew where I was, I found myself mumbling responses which were whispered in my ear and vouching for things of which I knew nothing, and generally assisting in the secure tying up of Irene Adler, spinster, to Godfrey Norton, bachelor. It was all done in an instant, and there was the gentleman thanking me on the one side and the lady on the other, while the clergyman beamed on me in front. It was the most preposterous position in which I ever found myself in my life. And it was the thought of it that started me laughing just now. It seems that there had been some informality about their license, and that the clergyman absolutely refused to marry them without a witness of some sort, and that my lucky appearance saved the bridegroom from having to sally out into the streets in search of a best man. The bride gave me a sovereign, and I mean to wear it on my watch chain in memory of the occasion.
"This is a very unexpected turn of affairs," said I. "And what then?"
Well, I found my plans very seriously menaced. It looked as if the pair might take an immediate departure, and so necessitate very prompt and energetic measures on my part. At the church door, however, they separated, he driving back to the temple and she to her own house. "I shall drive out in the park at 5, as usual," she said as she left him. I heard no more. They drove away in different directions, and I went off to make my own arrangements.
"Which are?"
"Oh, some cold beef and a glass of beer," he answered, ringing the bell. "I have been too busy to think of food, and I am likely to be busier still this evening. By the way, Doctor, I shall want your cooperation."
"I shall be delighted."
"You don't mind breaking the law?"
"Not in the least."
"Nor running a chance of arrest?"
"Not in a good cause."
"Oh, the cause is excellent."
"Then I am your man."
"I was sure that I might rely on you."
"But what is it you wish?"
"When Mrs. Turner has brought in the tray, I will make it clear to you. Now," he said as he turned hungrily on the simple fare that our landlady had provided, "I must discuss it while I eat, for I have not much time. It is nearly 5 now. In 2 hours we must be on the scene of action. Miss Irene, or Madam, rather,
returns from her drive at 7. We must be at Briony Lodge to meet her.
Well, and then what?
Oh, you must leave that to me. I have already arranged what is to occur. There is only one point on which I must insist. You must not interfere, come what may. You understand?
I am to be neutral.
To do nothing whatever. There will probably be some small unpleasantness. Do not join in it. It will end in my being conveyed into the house. 4 or 5 minutes afterward, the sitting room window will open. You ought to station yourself close to that open window.
Yes.
You ought to watch me, for I will be visible to you.
Yes.
And when I raise my hand, so, you will throw into the room what I give you to throw and will, at the same time, raise the cry of fire. You quite follow me?
Entirely.
Oh, it is nothing very formidable, he said, taking a long cigar-shaped roll from his pocket. It is an ordinary plumber's smoke rocket, fitted with a cap at either end to make it self-lighting. Your task is confined to that. When you raise your cry of fire, it will be taken up by quite a number of people. You may then walk to the end of the street, and I will rejoin you in 10 minutes. I hope that I have made myself clear.
I am to remain neutral. To get near the window, to watch you, and at the signal to throw in this object, then to raise the cry of fire, and to wait you at the corner of the street.
Precisely.
Then you may entirely rely on me.
That is excellent. I think, perhaps, it is almost time that I prepare for the new role I have to play. He disappeared into his bedroom and returned in a few minutes in the character of an amiable and simple-minded nonconformist clergyman, his broad black hat, his baggy trousers, his white tie, his sympathetic smile, and general look of peering and benevolent curiosity were such as Mr. John Hare alone could have equaled. It was not merely that Holmes changed his costume. His expression, his manner, his very soul seemed to vary with every fresh part that he assumed. The stage lost a fine actor, even as science lost an acute reasoner when he became a specialist in crime. It was 6:15 when we left Baker Street, and it still wanted 10 minutes to the hour when we found ourselves in Serpentine Avenue. It was already dusk, and the lamps were just being lighted as we paced up and down in front of Briony Lodge, waiting for the coming of its occupant. The house was just such as I had pictured it from Sherlock Holmes' succinct description, but the locality appeared to be less private than I expected. On the contrary, for a small street in a quiet neighborhood, it was remarkably animated. There was a group of shabbily dressed men smoking and laughing in a corner, a scissors grinder with his wheel, 2 guardsmen who were flirting with a nurse girl, and several well-dressed young men who were lounging up and down with cigars in their mouths. "You see," remarked Holmes as we paced to and fro in front of the house, "this marriage rather simplifies matters. The photograph becomes a double-edged weapon now. The chances are that she would be as averse to its being seen by Mr. Godfrey Norton as our client is to its coming to the eyes of his princess. Now the question is, where are we to find the photograph?"
"Where, indeed?"
"Well, it is most unlikely that she carries it about with her. It is cabinet-size. Too large for easy concealment about a woman's dress. She knows that the king is capable of having her waylaid and searched. 2 attempts of that sort have already been made. We may take it, then, that she does not carry it about with her."
"Where, then?"
"Her banker or her lawyer. There is that double possibility, but I am inclined to think neither. Women are naturally secretive, and they like to do their own secreting. Why should she hand it over to anyone else? She could trust her own guardianship, but she could not tell what indirect or political influence might be brought to bear upon a businessman. Besides, remember that she had resolved to use it within a few days. It must be where she can lay her hands upon it. It must be in her own house."
"But it has twice been burgled."
"Sure, they did not know how to look."
"But how will you look?"
"I will not look."
"What then?"
"I will get her to show me."
"Oh, but she will refuse."
"Oh, she will not be able to. But I hear the rumble of wheels. It is her carriage. Now carry out my orders to the letter." As he spoke, the gleam of the sidelights of a carriage came round the curve of the avenue. It was a smart little landau which rattled up to the door of Briony Lodge. As it pulled up, one of the loafing men at the corner dashed forward to open the door in the hope of earning a copper.
but was elbowed away by another loafer who had rushed up with the same intention. A fierce quarrel broke out, which was increased by the two guardsmen who took sides with one of the loungers, and by the scissor grinder who was equally hot upon the other side. A blow was struck, and in an instant the lady who had stepped from her carriage was in the center of a little knot of flushed and struggling men who struck savagely at each other with their fists and sticks. Holmes dashed into the crowd to protect the lady, but just as he reached her, he gave a cry and dropped to the ground, with the blood running freely down his face. At his fall, the guardsmen took to their heels in one direction, and the loungers in the other, while a number of better-dressed people who had watched the scuffle without taking part in it crowded in to help the lady and to attend to the injured man. Irene Adler, as I will still call her, had hurried up the steps, but she stood at the top with her superb figure outlined against the lights of the hall, looking back into the street. "Is the poor gentleman much hurt?" she asked.
"He is dead!" cried several voices. "No, no, there's life in him!" shouted another. "But he'll be gone before you get him to hospital."
"He's a brave fellow," said a woman. "They would have had the lady's purse and watch if it hadn't been for him. They were a gang and a rough one, too. Oh, he's breathing now."
"Oh, you can't lay in the street. May we bring him in, ma'am?"
"Surely. Bring him into the sitting room. There is a comfortable sofa. This way, please."
Slowly and solemnly he was borne into Briony Lodge and laid out in the principal room, while I still observed the proceedings from my post by the window. The lamps had been lit, but the blinds had not been drawn, so that I could see Holmes as he lay upon the couch. I do not know whether he was seized with compunction at that moment for the part he was playing, but I know that I never felt more heartily ashamed of myself in my life than when I saw the beautiful creature against whom I was conspiring, or the grace and kindliness with which she waited upon the injured man. And yet it would be the blackest treachery to Holmes to draw back now from the part which he had entrusted to me. I hardened my heart and took the smoke rocket from under my ulster. After all, I thought, we are not injuring her. We are but preventing her from injuring another. Holmes had sat up upon the couch, and I saw him motion like a man who is in need of air. A maid rushed across and threw open the window. At the same instant, I saw him raise his hand, and at the signal I tossed my rocket into the room with a cry of, "Fire!" The word was no sooner out of my mouth than the whole crowd of spectators, well-dressed and ill, gentlemen, ostlers, and servant-maids, joined in a general shriek of, "Fire!" Thick clouds of smoke curled through the room and out at the open window. I caught a glimpse of rushing figures, and a moment later the voice of Holmes from within assuring them that it was a false alarm. Slipping through the shouting crowd, I made my way to the corner of the street, and in 10 minutes was rejoiced to find my friend's arm in mine, and to get away from the scene of the uproar. He walked swiftly and in silence for some few minutes until we had turned down one of the quiet streets which lead towards the Edgware Road.